Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
They started Oculus in 2012. They ended up selling it to Facebook in 2014 for almost $3 billion. And so It felt like another great underdog, scrappy.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. So let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice.
Hey, everybody. I've got a special guest today, Blake J. Harris. He's going to talk about the two books he's written about video games and technology, along with one of them being turned into both a documentary and a TV series, and all these crazy stories about writing for both of those. We had some technical issues, but we worked through them, and I think you're going to enjoy it.
Hey, thanks, Blake, for being on the show. How are you doing?
I am good. Thank you for having me on. It's nice to talk to you again. We spoke a couple of years ago about your time in the game industry, so I'm glad to return the favor and talk about my time on the periphery of the industry.
Cool. And you've got a lot of stuff going on here. First question I just kind of want to get into is your upcoming documentary, The Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle to Define a Generation, premiering at South by Southwest.
Yeah, so I'm really excited. The film premieres on mid-March. I don't think I mentioned a date yet, but the project is 7 years in the making, so I'm super excited to get it done. I mean, I was 90% excited when we got into South By just because it's South By, and then 10% excited just because finally this thing was going to be over, which just means that because it was such a long process, it actually goes back to 2013. And at the time, I was starting to think about doing the book, and I was talking about the idea with my friend Jonah Tulis, who I've done a lot of filmmaking stuff with, and he suggested that we also do a documentary in addition to the book. And I remember thinking, my initial thought was, wow, even if it was just 90 minutes of old Sega and Nintendo commercials, that would probably be pretty entertaining. So if you actually add a story to that, you probably can't go wrong. And so we shot most of the interviews back in 2013 and 2014 when I was writing the book. And then over the years, it's because the documentary is it's not technically an adaptation of the book, but it's related to the book, and the book's being adapted into what was then a movie, and now it's going to be a TV show with Legendary Pictures and CBS All Access. It was always like the documentary had obligations related to the series, and so now it's awesome that we're finally able to finish it. And and you know, as frustrating as it has been that it's taken 7 years creatively, I couldn't be happier with what Jonah and I have been able to do. An interesting process to go about, clearly with the actual story, I took 550 pages to tell it. So to try to tell the story again in 89 minutes is a different sort of challenge. And then there's also all sorts of luxuries to being able to tell it this way, particularly the archival footage. There's so much great footage that has never been seen or, you know, is cool on its own, but in the context of this larger story is even more compelling. There's a nostalgia factor that'll be really nice to tie this all together. And then we have all the main characters that were featured in the book, like Tom Kalinske and Al Nilsen and Ellen Beth Van Buskirk and Howard Lincoln and Peter Main. And, you know, it's been very satisfying to work on.
Yeah. So you interviewed all them present day, kind of reflecting back and talking about everything and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. We spent a day or so with each of them and did, like, you know, 5 to 8 hour long interviews with all these people, and really got to speak with all the key players. You know, that's always a big concern whenever you're writing something or if you're making a film, even though this is my first film, that you're not gonna be able to get all the participants and you're not gonna be able to have all the sides of the story. And as with the book, I always wish I was able to interview Mr. Arakawa, who had been the head of Nintendo of America before Howard Lincoln was promoted, but at least we got Howard Lincoln. And he, you know, they were such a dynamic duo. At least he's able to sort of speak for what they were thinking at the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's really nice to see all those people. I think it's also just, it'll be fun too, because these people have such a unique voice. That's what made them so fun to write about. Yeah. And I think that sometimes in the book, because they were so playful or they were such good characters, people sometimes thought that I embellished or that I dramatized those aspects of them, but it was actually the opposite. It was actually, I was just really lucky to have these great people. So I'm glad that people will now get to hear them in their own voice and not the Blake Harris voice or what they think is a Blake Harris telling. Yeah. Be able to hear Tom Kalinske and Howard Lincoln and Peter Main.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. And I worked with Al Nilsen mid-90s. He was at Viacom New Media. I was at the office, the dev studio in Chicago. And there was a lot of lore around him. I didn't really know the whole story. I just remember he would always say the name of the game is the game. You know, that was always his line. And when I read your book, it was cool to learn more about Al and what he'd done at Sega. Because it was just something like, you know, people talked about Sega and things, but it wasn't really clear. There was no internet back then. You could Google somebody or Wikipedia them. So I really enjoyed learning about them.
All of this is, like, you know, I think people like you and I, we grew up without the internet. And then also when we were in our teens or 20s, like, had the internet. So we sort of straddled an existence, an adult existence that's, like, had, you know, understanding of both. But that was a big thing back then. Like, even just as a consumer, like when I was very young with the NES era, I remember going to KB Toys once with my parents at the mall, and they were going to buy my brother and I a game, which, you know, usually we had to get it for, like, a birthday present or Hanukkah or something, but they were just going to reward us, and we got to choose a game. And our entire criteria for choosing the game was just the box. Cause, like, there was no way to, like, Google it or be like, like, you know, so it was just, there was such a gap of information and a lack of context connecting all these things. So you heard this lore of Al Nilsen, even if you had heard things about all these people, just there wasn't really much that connected them all together into this larger story. And that's what we have the benefit of doing here, which is as a historian or nonfiction writer, it's always sort of the fun thing is to take all these disparate pieces and put them together in a way that is accessible and understandable. And you see how the pieces fit together.
Yeah. And I had a weird kind of perspective on all this too, because, you know, I was at TurboGrafx at the time, which was the underdog that stayed the underdog and then just never materialized. But, you know, we were trying to battle head to head with Sega, especially, and it was just such an uphill battle. And, you know, I remember one time, like, 12 games out for the TurboGrafx and 6 for the Genesis, you know, so we'd be like, we got twice as many games as the Genesis has. But, you know, they had Joe Montana football and we had TV sports football, where the players were named after the programmers, right? Like, you want to be Joe the programmer, you want to be Joe Montana, right? So Sega understood that licensing. They had some great games, and it was tough to fight them. And then when the SNES came out and got traction, it was just it was a 2-horse race, you know. So it was frustrating. But yeah, you used to go to the Toys R Us and you see the kiosks, you know, for both of them, and I was like, I should go sabotage that Genesis one, you know. But it was interesting times. Just, and then it was always arguments too about 16-bit versus not 16-bit with the turbo and things. But
were you surprised? I mean, what one aspect of my book that you and I had talked about in the past that, like, you know, if I were to do it, there's things I would change. This probably wouldn't be it just because the book is already very long and expansive, but it just kind of shows these stories that there's always more to them. And like one thing that's not in the book that I find fascinating, but didn't really fit, was like the first console war between Sega and TurboGrafx before they even really took on Nintendo.
Yeah.
And so you guys were sort of like the, you know, the trailblazing 16-bit new gen, next gen consoles. Were you surprised that, even if you guys had not, you turned out to not be successful in that way, but were you surprised that Sega was able to make a dent in Nintendo like they were able to?
Yeah, because Sega, at least in America, was always kind of the underdog. I remember researching, you know, I'm older and I'd gotten out of college and I was looking at video game systems and it was like, I could get a NES or a Master System, and the NES just felt too kiddy. And I bought a Master System, and I enjoyed the Master System, but it was always, NES was always number one, right? So, they were always kind of the underdog. And then Nintendo kind of stalled with getting the Super Nintendo out, because I think they wanted to just keep, you know, pushing the NES and making their money with that. So when we came out, we thought we had a shot. And I was surprised that Sega, you know, was able to turn things around. I remember they had like Buster Douglas, the fighting game and the boxing game and all these like kind of bombs and stuff. And then when Kalinske came on board, it seemed to kind of like get new life and really take it to the next level. And we just never could. I mean, we had the great hardware. We had the first CD-ROM, the first 5-player, you know, the same chip would work in both the portable system, which was fantastic, but overpriced, and the home system. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's about the games, and you can have the greatest hardware in the world, but if you don't have the games people want to play, you're not going to win.
And the marketing, which is funny that Allo is saying the game is the game, because Sega success was so much about marketing, not even the games. I would argue that their games weren't as good as their success would dictate, but they were so good at marketing. So it's ironic that Al, who was their head of marketing, always goes to that line, which is certainly true to a large degree. And it's good that that's his guiding principle to never make a game like E.T., but marketing was a big deal and part of Sega's formula.
So what kind of feedback did you get to the from the book when you initially came out with the book? You know, how was that?
The book was life-changing for me. At my entire 20s, from 1 week after I graduated college until literally the day of my 30th birthday, I worked at a financial brokerage in Manhattan at Rockefeller Center trading commodities for Brazilian clients. So it was my day job and not what I wanted to do. I wanted to write. And then selling that book to HarperCollins allowed me to quit my day job and write full time. And then it came out and I was very, very happy with how it was received. There's certainly some people who really didn't like it, but fortunately that was a minority of people. And I did not expect that, however, what is it, 6 years later now, almost 6 years, that people would still be talking about the book, still be, you know, the book still sells very well every week. I did not expect that. So that's been amazing.
No, it's cool. You know, it's a marketing term, evergreen, right? Because it's not cyclical or just kind of a one thing. It's like there's that history there and people want to know about it. And that's great. It keeps selling.
Yeah. I mean, that was the goal. But, you know, as you know, like the goal and the objective is not always how it turns out. Like I definitely tried to write Console Wars. And same thing with the documentary too, to do it in a way that it would be appealing to anybody, not just gamers, not just people from the 90s, but I always think about my grandmother, like how is she going to respond to this? How can I get her to care about, you know, 60 minutes, or to care about Tom Kalinske? And it is by telling the human story, by finding the universal aspects, by finding the stuff that goes beyond the specific battle. And
yeah. So what's a funny or unusual story discovered writing this book?
So there were a lot, which is part of what made the process so fun. I did genuinely feel like every day I'd wake up and there was new things that I was learning, which is certainly not always the case with everything I've worked on, and has made it a little bit hard to find projects that I want to sink my teeth into for years at a time and write books on.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of my favorites was, I had always been trying to get in touch with Hayao Nakayama, who's the president of Sega of Japan and plays a big role in the book and obviously in this whole story as the patriarch of Sega in Japan. And I had not heard back from him until I was in Japan for, so I was working on promotional videos for Sega at the time, which is a whole other interesting side story.
Yeah.
But while I was out there, I got an email from someone who claimed to be Nakayama saying that they had heard I was looking to speak with them and that if I still wanted to be waiting at my hotel room on Friday at like 2 o'clock or something. And I, of course, did wait there. Mm-hmm. And I was greeted by two gentlemen who spent a couple of hours asking me questions. And I guess I passed their test and they brought me over to Nakayama's residence, which is a very beautiful home.
Hmm.
And then I spoke with Nakayama-san for a few hours, and it was everything I hoped he would be. He was a character in some ways, also just, you know, he's a larger than life character, also very smart guy, very interesting guy. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's always sort of the more fun parts for me is like when, you know, I'm hearing about all these people because I'm asking them questions about characters, other people that are part of the story. So mm-hmm. when I finally meet the ones that I hadn't been in touch with, it's always interesting to see how what I had heard of them, you know, whether that seems to, if I had the right impression of them and sort of see right. things from their perspective.
Yeah, there was a whole, like, I think it was towards the beginning of the book where Tom got picked up in Japan with like some stretch black limo and he was yeah. in there drinking whiskey and stuff yeah. like that. Or
yeah, like, well, I mean, that's like... Mm-hmm. The book actually starts because with a story that Tom told me, which is like, I remember him telling me the story and that was kind of what clinched that I wanted to spend my next few years working on this book. It was him in Hawaii on vacation, unrelated to anything with Sega, because he wasn't in the video game industry at the time. He was actually like between jobs and sort of looking for a new job. And mm-hmm. then he was approached on the beach by Hayao Nakayama, the guy I was just talking about.
Yeah,
who was on the beach in a suit, which is unusual. And he says to Tom, you know, like Tom's like, what the heck are you doing here? Guy in a suit. And he says, I'm looking for you. I want you to come with me to Japan. I want to show uh-huh. you the 16-bit technology and I want you to run Sega. And yeah, so that also gets a little bit to what I was saying earlier. That sounds,
yeah.
That kind of sounds like a dramatized story that I could see a screenwriter like making up or that someone might think I really embellished, but that was mm-hmm. the actual story. And it was
right.
you know, amazing. And I was very lucky that I had this great material to work with.
Yeah. I mean, it just writes itself. When you hear that, you're just like, what? And he's in a suit in Hawaii
yeah.
stalking him. And because yeah, Tom was there with his family on vacation.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
you know, it's like, okay, I guess I can't say no.
Yeah.
So what about, besides the documentaries, anything you can talk about with the TV series? That's CBS All Access, right?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Unfortunately, there's not that much I can talk about at this time. They mm-hmm. are, it's the same, you know, CBS All Access is the one who's going to be distributing the documentary and who we've obviously been working with for the past year. They've
yeah.
been a great partner. And they're also developing the scripted TV series, which is being directed by Jordan Voight Roberts and written by Mike Rosolio. We have a pilot script that is the best script I've ever read. I get biased, but I'm usually very hard on scripts because there's a reason I don't screenwrite anymore and I prefer writing prose. But Mike Rosolio did an awesome job. And I look forward to providing an update on that when I can. But knock on wood, things are moving along, and I'm very happy with that as well. You know, it's kind of this story has become very personal to me between telling
yeah.
it as a book and between telling it as a documentary, and in between between both of them, putting like 4 or 5 years of my life into it. So I was a little nervous reading this screenplay because I didn't know how it would match up to my vision, and I do feel a sense of ownership with how the story was told. And then also at the same time, there's real people involved that I know and oftentimes care about. But Mike did an amazing job, so I'm feeling good about things there. And I look forward to providing an update when I can.
Yeah, and right, because you could have been like, wow, this
yeah.
you know, didn't capture what I was trying to do, or there's too much embellishment or something. So I'm sure.
Well, yeah, it's like you just said, like, you know, what I've found over the past 8 years as I've gone from trading commodities to nonfiction writing and storytelling mm-hmm. is, you know, truth really is so often stranger than fiction. And so it would have been almost like a bummer to me if a screenwriter sensationalized it, because they didn't need to, because the actual story is so interesting. So I was really glad that Mike leaned into that, and that he always asked me questions about, you know, like he wants to know what actually happened. He's not just taking these characters mm-hmm. and using them as puppets to tell whatever story he wants to tell.
Right.
But yeah, the truth really is stranger than fiction.
Yeah. So now transitioning to your second book, The History of the Future, Oculus, Facebook, and the Revolution That Swept Virtual Reality. What was that like? That's a big book too. A lot of research, a lot of time. How did that go?
It went very weirdly. I don't know if you've read the book or if you're familiar with the story.
I downloaded it. I have it on Audible. So I downloaded it yesterday. So yeah.
Well, the good news is that, like Console Wars, I hopefully wrote it in an evergreen way. So there's no urgency on your end to listen to it. It'll be relevant, whatever. Like you said earlier, the subtitle of the book of Console Wars is Sega Nintendo, The Battle That Defined a Generation. And there's, you know, some tongue-in-cheekness to the Battle to Find a Generation part, but also it really did.
Yeah.
You know, the Sega Nintendo battle is something that really meant a lot to a lot of people my age who grew up in the 80s and the 90s, who have such fond memories and so many memories associated with that. And so I wanted to find a topic that I thought would have a similar cultural resonance and, you know, a sort of an overlap of the Venn diagram between culture and gaming and Hollywood and technology and big personalities. And so I was really intrigued by Oculus, which had started in 2012 and also had a similar great, you know, chapter one that just sort of seemed to immediately reveal itself to me, which is, you know, back in 2012, Palmer Luckey, who was a 19-year-old kid at the time, was working away in a trailer in Long Beach, California, and sort of like a mad scientist. And he created this headset called the Oculus Rift, a prototype. And
hey, hope you're enjoying the show. If you are, please go to patreon.com/gamedevadvice. We'd love to see if you can support the show and help new episodes keep coming out. That's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks.
It ended up, you know, he ended up starting a company with the help of a few other people and also getting a lot of publicity due to a fortuitous connection and support from John Carmack. And they started Oculus in 2012. They ended up selling it to Facebook in 2014 for almost $3 billion. And so it felt like another great underdog, scrappy story, which it is, I should say, like that proved to be true. But I started working on the book in 2015 and the book came out last year. It came out in 2019. And by the time the book came out, Palmer Luckey had been fired from Facebook for reasons that had nothing to do with virtual reality or technology, but had to do with politics and his political support for Donald Trump, who is then a candidate and eventually a president, who I personally really dislike. But I also think everybody in the country has the right to support whatever candidate they want, especially in a two-party system. And so I was pretty devoted to trying to tell a fair story and to try to get the full story, which was hard because there was some chicanery involved and Mark Zuckerberg coercing Palmer to lie about his politics and, you know, a whole scandal. Basically, so I mention all that just because the process was not at all like I expected. It delved into a lot of territories that I had not expected to write about, nor did I have much interest in writing about. But I felt that it was my responsibility to see the story through to the end, and that's what I did. And it was exhausting and grueling, but I do think that what resulted was a very important book and a look at our times, especially with the control that companies like Facebook and other big Silicon Valley companies have. And you know, it's just interesting to see the inner workings there and like some of the hypocrisies. And it personally made me very concerned about Facebook. But
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff you know about the ads right now and how they're not monitored. And there's just blatant stuff that's, you know, ads that are running on Facebook that people take as truth and all this.
Right.
There is a lot of crazy stuff. And then, but it's cool that you followed where it went, right? You know, you chased the story down and you didn't go in there with like a narrative or a direction and you try to frame it.
Yeah.
In that way.
It was very hard. And it was also very, it was very helpful to me. Cause like I said, I'm someone who really does not care for Donald Trump. And I found it depressing that he won the presidency and, you know, disappointing that half the country or, you know, half of my fellow countrymen would vote for him. But I also, by following the story to the end, at least understand a lot more of where they're coming from. And it forced me to be much more tolerant of other people's views and to realize that it's not as much of a good and bad, even though Donald Trump himself is very objectionable to me, that, you know, people have valid reasons for voting him and things that I didn't really think that much about. So I guess it's a long way of saying that it forced me to be more tolerant and more thoughtful and also really caused me to lose a lot of trust in the media, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the what happened with Palmer was so misreported. And as one of the few people who actually, you know, I had access to all the players involved, like Palmer and some of the other participants, and I knew what had really happened. And it was troubling to see how inaccurately it was reported. And then it was even more troubling that when I reached out to these people as a fellow journalist, they didn't really care what I had to say because it didn't fit their narrative. Which is like not what you want to hear from fellow journalists.
Right, right, right. Yeah, it's like, tell me what information you have. Don't try to fit in the box. Yeah. What about researching this? Were you traveling a lot, or like what was different between this book versus Console Wars in terms of the research, or how did you?
It's a good question. It was pretty different because, like I said, Console Wars was my first experience reporting and interviewing people. So I learned a lot about, I guess I just got a lot better, I should say. I also, access was, it took a very, very long time to get the access I wanted. But in general, it was much easier for me to get interviews with people than it was with Console Wars, because back then I was just a commodities broker reaching out to Tom Kalinske or Al Milson and saying, hey, do you have time to talk to this guy with the dream? And fortunately, those are both people who are very helpful to journalists of all stripes. But, but you know, whereas with this book, at least I had something under my belt to say, here, look, I've written a book. A lot of people read it and many seem to like it. You know, it's easier to get people's time. Even
street
though,
cred.
Yeah, exactly. And I also, just, you know, I was able to think, it helped me think about writing the book better. You know, I sort of like to operate. For as long as possible, I like to not have any specific plan for the story. I like to just collect as many ingredients as I can and then start cooking the meal. And I guess knowing that I'd done it before gave me the confidence that I could do that for even longer this time, which turned out to be 3.5 years. I mean, I guess I started writing at some point. But yeah, I mean, it was less traveling and more just staying in touch with people very frequently by text message or Facebook Messenger or email. You know, whereas with Console Wars, I did a lot of interviews, but the dialogues sort of didn't continue from there. Whereas with the more recent book, I felt like it was just almost like an ongoing interview with so many of these different people. And that was also, you know, that I was able to do that because I had a little more credibility, but also it was interesting because Console Wars, when I started writing it in 2012, was a story that had already happened in the 90s, 20 years earlier. So I kind of knew the beginning, middle, and end roughly when I started. Whereas with this book, Oculus was riding high when I started, and they were coming out with their first product in March 2016. And so it was like telling the story in real time. So it was much more valuable to me to have those relationships and to actually get the real-time reactions from the executives as things were happening, as opposed to how they remembered it years later.
Yeah, yeah, two different contexts, right? Yeah. What about like a funny or unusual story from this book? Like what's something stands out that was like, wow?
Again, it's like there's so much stuff that really surprised me. I'm just trying to think of like what's the best one to tell for people who aren't familiar with the book. I mean, Palmer Luckey is a character, so there's a lot of great Palmer stories. Like I said, you know, he's also an eccentric guy. He was living in this trailer at the beginning of the book. I guess the most interesting thing to me was just the most interesting thing to me was. With this book, unlike the other book, I was able to get access to over 25,000 emails by the end of it all. And so in a way that I could never do with Console Wars, because there wasn't really email for most of that story. And then also I didn't have access to whatever internal system they had. After I had a sense of the story, I had interviewed everyone for about a year. Ended up getting these emails and I was able to go back and see the whole story evolve just from all their interactions and seeing the start of the company that way.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting to see what they remembered correctly and incorrectly, and maybe why they remembered things differently to benefit themselves.
Yeah.
And I will say that like that was also really impressed me about Palmer, because he is a controversial, polarizing figure. He does sort of revel in that a little bit, but as a journalist, he's kind of a dream subject, because he does remember things accurately, and like everything he said turned out to be true, for better or for worse. It was nice to see that confirmed after seeing all these emails.
Yeah, that's wild that you had access to that level of emails and you could verify things. And and it shows you did your homework, right? That you really dug into this and made it your life just trying to make sure all this stuff was accurate.
And that was a big part of it too, because again, Console Wars was a story that happened 20 years ago. There's a lot of recreated dialogue in that book that is in the spirit of the conversation, but is obviously not exactly word for word. Whereas, and I work with the subjects in Console Wars to try to make that dialogue as accurate as possible and as authentic as possible. But with this book, because of how poorly the media reported on Palmer, I felt like I needed to raise my game and be even more accurate and not even have things that were, quote, like in the spirit of a conversation, but actually make sure that these were like verbatim quotes and everything in the book I had a record of these people saying, because I didn't want to be accused of being the, you know, sort of what I was ultimately criticizing about the reporting.
Right.
And so having those emails was one thing that really helped me have that confidence and make sure that I not only knew what was, you know, was able to write what was in the book, but I also knew maybe things I didn't know, like things that I would have looked foolish to not realize were part of the context. So it gave me a lot of confidence.
So in terms of, you know, technology, you've got a pretty good perspective on that. Like, what are you excited about around, you know, AR, VR, mixed reality platforms? Like, and what concerns you also about those platforms?
Yeah, that's a good question. I definitely lost some of my excitement just because of how things played out at the end of the Oculus story. You know, my interest is always more, from a writing perspective, my interest is always more the people, the human story. And so seeing how a human like Palmer was treated and seeing how things ended for his co-founders, you know, none of which are at Facebook anymore because, of, you know, they clearly weren't happy there or Facebook wasn't happy with them, did sort of sour my opinion on VR, which it probably shouldn't feel, you know, the average person shouldn't feel that way because VR is still amazing and the Oculus Quest is awesome. But but I am really... I wanted to write the book because I felt VR was going to be generation defining or, you know, have a big cultural resonance. And I still feel that way, whether it's AR or, you know, sort of VR. I guess I'm really excited and hopeful for having seen companies do what I would consider the wrong thing, like Facebook in particular, or companies involved that I don't necessarily trust, like Facebook. I'm very eager to see two companies that I have more admiration for and get into it, which is Nintendo and Apple. It remains to be seen when and if either of those companies will really jump into the mixed reality space in a big way. But I love that Nintendo is doing, you know, they had the VR Labo stuff, which wasn't that great, but at least they were getting in there. They had the VR Mario Kart stuff, which is great. And then they just have like the IP that I think it's going to take to make VR really take off in the same way that, you know, like the Pokemon augmented reality experience,
right?
Which is a, you know, it's kind of AR, or let's say it is AR. That was what made that so popular was not just the technology, it was the IP, it was having the Pokemon brand. So I'd love to see Nintendo be more a part of this because I think that they have some of the greatest IP. And then Apple has done such a great job of making seemingly sci-fi technology mainstream appeal. So I'm really eager to see what they do with AR or VR. What are you excited for in that space?
You know, I like the Quest myself because the low barrier of entry, right? Like you just turn it on, you put it on, you know, the HTC Vive, you got that laptop and then something doesn't work and you plug it back in and it works. And it just feels very hobbyist to me.
Yep.
And it's kind of frustrating, but the Quest, you know, you just throw it on, you can get in that experience, you know, quickly with the low friction point.
Yep.
And all the other kind of unique stuff, like a buddy of mine, Andrea, is a company that's getting into virtual reality, you know, meditation, right? So it's Third Eye.
Yeah.
Studios or something where, you know, you can go to this environment and there'll be like a live thing and you can meet people. And granted, when you meditate, your eyes are closed, but the idea that, you can experience this stuff and maybe you can't physically, but, being able to meditate in VR and like interact with other people, is kind of cool. So like, you know, what can you do with this technology? You know, where can you do different stuff? You know, besides a Pokemon or things like that.
Right.
It's just cool to see how it's evolving. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was always what fascinated me as the beyond gaming aspect, which is also what interested Facebook, the social component. But I liked the idea of the medical uses and the meditation or, you know, entertainment uses or the being able for me to, my brother lives 2,000 miles away. So being able to do something with him, so we're together virtually, even if we're not physically together, I always liked that. And I do think the Quest despite my misgivings about Facebook, the Quest is great. And I this is speculative on my part, but I do believe that all the people who ended up, you know, who had started Oculus and ended up either being fired or leaving because they didn't like Facebook, I think they would all do it again because they did it because part of the reason for selling to Facebook was that it led to something like the Quest. It led to a company being willing to put in the billions of dollars,
yeah,
make a few hundred dollar product that had the, you know, the low friction points that you're talking about and the great experience for an somewhat affordable price.
Yeah. The things that kind of scare me about that a little bit though, too, is that I hear about, you know, like your movements, and, you know, it captures your movements. And is that data then going to be potentially, who knows if it's true or not, but like repurposed and like, you know, sold to companies and things like that, you know, it's like your gait and how you move and all right. The things around.
Yeah, I mean, that's movement. Really like VR is an incredibly cool technology. It's also the most intrusive technology that you can imagine. It's it is, in order to deliver what you're seeing and make you feel like the world is moving with you virtually, it has to, you know, scan your body movements and also scan the environment around you, which means that, mm-hmm. that you're basically you're putting cameras in your home and having this hardware track your movements, which sounds terrifying if, you know, Facebook is not being diligent with keeping that information or using it for the purposes they say. And even though they might say the right things, they've lost a lot of credibility over the past years. And they're typically what happens is either that data is misappropriated or it's being used for things that they're lying about. And then they just apologize years later when it's already too late. So I'm pretty conflicted about it, but as a piece of technology, it's very, very cool.
Are there any games that you're playing right now or any things that you're excited about in the gaming space or technology space?
I've not had much time to do stuff lately.
Yeah.
Especially as we're in crunch now to finish up this documentary for South By, which is starts in mid-March. But but in general, like I usually every night before I go to bed, I try to play my Nintendo Switch. That's like how to unwind. And it usually is retro games. It's usually, I really like the Zelda game, so I usually play that on like the Nintendo Online, you know, the virtual NES.
Yeah.
But then I also played the Link's Awakening, the 3D version that they had on the Switch. So I'm usually playing Switch stuff, or I was playing Cuphead recently. You know, I never really got into first-person shooters, so a lot of what's popular on you know, the major consoles is not stuff that I spend a lot of time doing. And Nintendo still makes fun platformers, which are kind of where my heart is still at.
Yeah. And it is such a, it is a great system. It just feels good in your hands and you know, you can download games quickly. And it seems like Nintendo hits that out of the park every other one. You know, it's like they have a home run and then they strike out and they have a home run. You know, you kind of almost track it that way with their hardware. It's like virtual boy, gave me a headache. What are you guys thinking? You know, it's like way too early for that.
Yep.
So have you seen the Sonic movie?
I have, and it's amazing. I encourage everyone to see it. I was very nervous about it over the past few months, as I think most people were. But it was amazing. I thought that Jim Carrey was awesome, and I thought Ben Schwartz played a perfect Sonic. I was really surprised by how much I loved it.
Yeah, it kind of got off to some shaky ground there where the initial images were out and they kind of went back and retooled it. And it was like, is this thing going to blow up or is it going to pan out? And it sounds like all the stuff I'm seeing online is response been very positive. So it's great.
Yeah. I also think it's a really good success story for listening to your audience. You know, I see so much nowadays where not just in the gaming space, but companies put out products or tease products. And then there's a very strong reaction to it. And I feel like the fans who are complaining are often demonized by the press. You know, this is certainly not a parallel example, but some of the stuff with Star Wars where it's almost like they're saying, no, the fans are wrong. And then that's fine if creatively you don't want to appeal to that base or if that you think that's just a small segment of the audience. But I do think there's an importance in listening to your audience. Doesn't mean you have to act on what you're hearing, but I do think it's important to know what your audience is thinking, what your most devoted people in the audience are thinking. And then in the case of Sonic, they listened to people who were upset. I wasn't upset, but I was definitely concerned, and they actually made it better. And they definitely wouldn't have had as great of a movie if they hadn't, you know, gotten that terrible the strong feedback and changed it.
Yeah. And again, you give them credit for doing that instead of just being like,
yeah,
well, what do you guys know? This is a movie we're making. Too bad. Is there anything I should have asked you about, but didn't?
Nothing that you should have asked me about, but one thing that I probably would want to say before we finish up is just how much I want there to be more behind the scenes looks at the history of video games, sort of the kind of work that I do, which I'm not alone in doing. You know, Jason Schreier has a very good book, and David Kushner, you know, his book, David Kushner's book with Masters of Doom, and his, and he wrote Jack. You know, there are people doing similar long form.
Josh Shui, you're familiar with Insert Coin, right?
Of course. Yeah. Josh is a friend where he's also going to be premiering his film at South.
Yeah.
We're doing a panel together. His documentary is awesome. It's about Midway and the arcade games that they made in the 90s, like Mortal Kombat and NBA Jam. Yeah. And I just wish that there was more of that. And I know why there's not, because I mean, I faced a lot of resistance from publishers and maybe from film. You know, it's tough because people, there's this perception that video game books or movies don't sell or that they don't translate, which I think is just not true, or it doesn't have to be true. So, you know, I like what you're doing as a podcast, and if there's anyone out there that has stories to tell, and wants some help trying to write a book or just get it out there, I am always happy to spend time talking to those people to try to figure out a way to help them. Doesn't always work out, but I write this stuff because this is the kind of stuff I want to read. So if there's anything I can do to help someone listening, you know, feel free to reach out.
Yeah. And speaking of that, like, how can people find you online? Your website, Twitter, like, what's the best way for people
Twitter,
follow you and get in touch with you?
Twitter is probably the best way. I'm at Blake J. Harris, NYC. I'm usually pretty good about responding. Maybe not until after South by Southwest, but in general, I'm pretty good. There's also, I have a website, blakejharris.com, and there's an email address on there that I check, you know, or things get sent to me pretty regularly. So I think I'm generally pretty accessible for anyone who wants to find me to say good things or bad things or share ideas.
And thanks for the feedback on the show, and excited to hear how it goes with you and Josh at South by Southwest. I hope the movies kind of help, I don't know, renaissance is the right word, but you know, kind of validate the fact that there are these great stories, and it's not just about the technology, it's about the humans, right? It's about the stories, you know, because with Josh's movie, I was not there at the time. I was there kind of for the hangover period where I joined at 2000. Mm-hmm. So I missed that wild period, but I know all those people, and there are fascinating stories, and so it's much more than just games. It's like the human element and the stories that went into the making of them that you know, like you'd said, truth is stranger than fiction, right? Like, you're like, what, people really did that or said that, or, you know, it's like, that can't be real, but it is. And that makes for great, you know, content, right? So great entertainment. And it's not just about pushing pixels and talking about graphics and CPUs and GPUs and stuff like that.
Yep.
Well, thank you for being a guest on the show here today. I think this has been fantastic, and wish you the best of luck at South by Southwest there.
Thanks, John. Hopefully I'll be back on the show at some point after you've seen the movie, and we could talk about it in greater detail.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'm actually going to be at GDC overlaps right at the same time as South by Southwest. So, but yeah, we'll have to do a follow-up after movie's out, and maybe even after the TV series is out too, because I'm excited to check that out. So, well, thank you, Blake, and have a great day.
You too. Thanks, John.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Go to the website at gamedevadvice.com, and you can find the show notes along with show notes for all the other episodes. Please also check out the new Patreon page at patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Have a lot of options up there for how you can support the show. Again, that's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks again for listening and being part of the show. Take care. Bye-bye.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.